Here are four principles for living like an American. Protect freedom. Take responsibility at all times. Express gratitude for every gift and opportunity. Become a source of love. Once again, these are the times that try our souls. We must find the strength and the courage to rise up to refound America in the spirit of liberty. Well, hello, my wonderful, wonderful audience. Once again, the anchor point of the week when I get to talk with all of you on our TV station. This is Dr. Peter Bregg, and most of you know I'm a psychiatrist, and you know I work very closely with my wife, Ginger, whom I am yet to get on to this show, but we're still struggling with it. I'd love to have her on. But you can hear us on the radio together on America Out Loud. Thursdays at 5 p.m., America Out Loud Pulse. This is Brighteon TV, and it's real TV. You can watch us on Roku. I'm just fixing a little something. A sticker blocked my timer over here. And it's just a wonderful opportunity for us, and we're very, very glad to be here. This will be an interesting show. We're gonna look at AIDS. And AIDS is kind of a model for COVID-19, and it all has to do with Anthony Fauci. Well, welcome back, folks. Have we got Rebecca Smith looking at us online here? It's all working well. We've been glitching lately, folks. We glitch, our guests glitch. I think it's the stress of all these things going on in the world today. Now, Rebecca has written a new book, The Real AIDS Epidemic. And she has read the real Anthony Fauci book, which many of you will have read. And there are real connections between the real AIDS epidemic and Bobby Kennedy's book, The Real Anthony Fauci. And her mother, at least, has been reading COVID-19 and the global predators. And she may have gotten through osmosis from her mom some of our book there. It all ties in together in amazing ways. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I'm glad to see you here. Why don't you tell us? I have your bio, but tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so my background is in mathematical modeling of immunological aspects of the human immunodeficiency virus. I received my PhD from Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, in Canada. In 2002, my dissertation was called Immune Response Models of HIV Infection and Treatment. And basically what I did was I constructed differential equation models of the interaction between HIV and the CD4 T cells in the immune system that it is claimed to deplete. That's what I worked on for a long time. And of necessity, I had to get extremely familiar with the medical literature regarding the mechanism of action of the alleged mechanism of action of the virus, its epidemiology, its immunological qualities. And the more that I read the literature, it became clear to me that what we were being told in the media about HIV being the necessary and sufficient cause of AIDS could not possibly be true. And so I began to kind of question that and look at alternative explanations of what was going on. And so fast forward a few years, I was working at a university in Texas, and I was becoming thoroughly disenchanted with the HIV theory of AIDS. It did not add up for many reasons that I can go into during this call. the most important being there are too many people with clinical AIDS that are HIV negative, and there are way too many people who test HIV positive that never develop AIDS. In mathematics, we have the concept of necessity and sufficiency, and I could see that HIV was neither necessary nor sufficient for clinical immunodeficiency. The picture actually gets way more interesting. We can discuss that a little bit later. So I really wanted to kind of shift my research focus. When you first get into a tenure track job, people don't want you to do that. They want you to stay in your lane, get a lot of publications, then you get tenure, and then you can kind of go and do something different. Being the rebel that I am, I was in touch with a friend of mine who was involved a little bit in sort of questioning, you know, the public health consensus of the causation of AIDS. And it's a weird story. I had written this little article late at night. This was 2006, called Why I Quit HIV. And it was just, it was almost like I had to get out all of the reasons why I could not in all conscience continue studying this particular field from this particular perspective. And I sent that into Lou Rockwell's website. You might be familiar with him. And he published it. The interview, the article quickly went viral. I think I got to my computer the next day and there were something like 800 emails from some people agreeing with me, some people disagreeing with me. I ended up writing a follow-up article just sort of describing some of the reactions that I'd had. And then I got a book deal for a book called Science Sold Out, which was published in 2007 by North Atlantic Publishing with a foreword by the late Harvey Bialy, who some people might know who he is. He was the editor of the Nature Biotechnology, which is a journal. I think it was just called Biotechnology at the time. So the book was published, and then I quickly started getting quite a bit of backlash. A letter writing campaign was organized, somewhere between scientists sent letters to the president of my university saying that I was dangerous and crazy and that they should not be supporting my research or my work. Other curious things happened as well. One of the criticisms was that I was giving medical advice to AIDS patients online, which I was not. And it turned out that there were actually people that were posing as me online and giving medical advice to AIDS patients. So I was being gaslit in that way. Eventually, I don't know what happened. I want to make it very, very clear right now that I was purposely not given the information as to why this happened. So I cannot say that it's because of my views on HIV.
My audience will believe you. Our audience are good people.
But I don't want to accuse anybody of anything that they didn't intend to do. And let me be very clear, when you don't have tenure, you are able to be fired at any time for any reason, and you don't need to be given the reason, which is what happened with me. I was brought in to the dean at the time and told that my contract would not be renewed. And I wasn't really given very good evidence, but the timing was awfully suspicious. So, of course, I could have at the time, I could have tried to find another job at a different university, perhaps someplace that was less research oriented that wouldn't have been so concerned about the political ramifications. My husband, he had full custody of his daughters at the time, and we needed to stay in the geographic location we were. So we made the decision that I was going to step away from my professional life for a while and raise our family. And I'm really glad that we did that. I probably would have had two fewer children had I stayed at my job. Anyway, fast forward to 2020, COVID started happening, and so much of the playbook just seemed so similar to AIDS, from the misuse of mathematical models, which we can talk about because it's fascinating, to just the stigmatization of a positive result on a test that is potentially not testing for what you think it's testing for, and we can talk about that as well, and just to the whole idea of isolating people. AIDS I would argue the HIV theory of AIDS is primarily about behavior control. And if we did not see the attempts to massively control behavior during COVID, then I'm not sure what we saw.
Yeah, exactly.
And so COVID happened and I decided, okay, I'm gonna start a Substack. I can write about this stuff. I know about mathematical modeling. I know a lot about medical tests and sensitivity and specificity and positive predictive value and all that stuff. I started a Substack and then I was approached, I want to say it was in April of 2022, by somebody who had referred my book to. He did mention my book several times in his book, The Real Anthony Fauci. The original book, Science Sold Out, was and through various, I got in touch with Tony Lyons, Skyhorse Publication, and he indicated that he wanted to republish the book, but with a lot more new material. There's the original book, I would say, I think it was 96 pages, and the new edition is going to be 160. There's quite a bit of new material. There's an extensive foreword, and afterward,
you're breaking up a little bit. I'm not sure. Is that on our end, do you know, our producers? Am I just seeing her breaking up, or is she breaking up on the public? We don't know.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, keep talking. Let me just go back to when you were breaking up. You were saying some really interesting things. So you ended up talking to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Mm-hmm. And he connected you with
it was actually a friend of his, but it happened because of his book. So
I gotcha. So a friend of his connected you with Skyhorse.
Yeah, I believe it was David Rasnick that first got in touch with me. You might be familiar with that name. He was a designer of protease inhibitors at one point, which is one of the drugs that's commonly used in treatment of HIV.
Yeah, no, I'm not a real expert on all of that. You're the expert and a hero, by the way. Let's get that straight. I mean, you're a hero.
Oh,
you're
thanks.
A hero in several ways. First in wanting to speak truth more than to get your PhD. That's a huge decision. I don't think 1 out of 1,000 people make a decision like that. Maybe it's 100 or 200,000 or 1,000,000. It is very rare for somebody to be on a career track and to decide basically that, I think you decided it was unethical, that you just couldn't
That's precisely what happened. And I have to say that I started to have doubts while I was doing my PhD. I was, for various reasons, I was really starting to question the HIV theory of AIDS. And I remember going to my advisor, who was a great guy, by the way, and showing him a mathematical analysis of one of papers that basically established the hit-early hard drug treatment. And it turned out the mathematical model was completely wrong. It did not do what it was supposed to do. It would, you read the models the way that they were supposed to be read, it predicted basically the depletion of every single T cell in the immune system within 2 months. So I took that to my advisor and he's like, okay, well, let's just not cite that paper, but let's just continue on. I was like, okay, you know, I'm gonna learn more. Maybe I will be convinced that there's nothing weird going on. And so, you know, I continued, and it was at that point, so I got my PhD in 2002, and by 2006, that was when I had my crisis of conscience, and I just couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
I just felt wrong and dirty.
Yeah, well, that's a wonderful thing for you to be able to do that. And then you did something else. Despite feminism, you realized the importance of raising children. And God bless you, you chose that. And how old are the children now?
My youngest is 12, and my oldest is 15, but our oldest is 23. I have a 22 and a 23-year-old stepdaughter as well.
And so the youngest child's still at home. Now, have you gone back to work at this point? What are you doing at this point?
Right now, I'm just trying to get my book out and publicized and sell some books, get the word out to people.
Yes. Well, I'm very glad you're here and very glad that, you know, that you've had the courage to do what you were doing. Do you think you'll ever go back in academia again?
I really don't know at this point. Academics has changed so much. My father was a professor, and I feel like there was a lot more intellectual freedom back in the 70s and 80s than there is now. There's a very disturbing trend towards trying to get as many publications pre-dissertation as possible. And as a result, people are going into fields where it's easier to produce quantity. And I would argue that quality suffers. So to answer your question, I don't know. I'll just have to see what the future holds and what happens when this book comes out on March 28th. You can pre-order it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. The Kindle edition on Amazon is going to be $2.99 for pre-sale, and that is going to go up after March 28th. So if you want to, I believe it's going to go up, I should say. So if you want to grab a copy at that good price, head on over to Amazon. And there's my shameless self-promotion.
Well, no, let's keep promoting it, and it's the real AIDS epidemic. Now, did you finally concluded that AIDS wasn't caused by HIV, right?
That is correct.
Let's talk about that.
Okay, so for sure, why don't I approach this from my perspective as somebody that constructs mathematical models? That's what I was trained to do. Do you mind if I just give the audience a little bit of background on what?
Oh, no, please go ahead.
Okay, so let me give you a real quick example, not to do with HIV. There's what are called SIR or SEIR epidemic models. And basically what they model, the progress of an infectious or non-infectious disease population, do things like determine how much of the population will be affected, based on certain parameters. One thing that is often done with these epidemiological models is they use them to estimate how much of a population needs to be vaccinated. So say you have a polio model, or you're modeling polio, and you would assume that this vaccine is going to have N% effectiveness against polio. So given that, you would incorporate that as a variable into the model, and the model would tell you something like, okay, so 75% of the population needs to be vaccinated to achieve herd immunity. One thing models cannot do is they cannot prove things. They can only quantify things. And what I mean by that is that when a model can't tell you that something has a certain effect, it can only tell you how much of an effect that it has. So for example, in my vaccine example, I'm assuming that the vaccine works. The model cannot tell me the vaccine works. And here's a good parallel with COVID. At the beginning, you probably remember the infamous Neil Ferguson Imperial College of London models that were, I think, pretty much discredited, where he basically said there's going to be, you know, 2 million deaths in America and however many million deaths in Great Britain, but if we implement social distancing, we can bring it down. Now, that model assumed that social distancing worked, and it just tried to spit out how much it worked. So I can't state this enough. A model is not going to tell you anything that you don't put into it. It will only quantify the effects of what you put into it. So
this is a real garbage in, garbage out.
Oh, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. I mean, you can construct a model to tell you anything. Their utility, as I mentioned, is in determining the quantity of effects. And they can be very, very useful, but they're not going to tell you anything that you don't already know scientifically. So fast forward to HIV modeling. The particular types of models that I had to do, they were not population level models. They were models of what happens when this supposed retrovirus HIV infects your CD4 T cells. And just let me go back and say that the initial, when HIV was initially discovered, what was going on was in the early 80s, people were showing up in emergency rooms with really bad opportunistic infections, pneumocystis pneumonia. There was Kaposi's sarcoma, which interestingly is not actually believed to be even caused by HIV anymore, which is astounding because wow. If you remember Philadelphia, the movie Philadelphia with Tom Hanks, and mm-hmm. You know, this is terrible visualization. He discovers these lesions, and that disease was basically synonymous with AIDS in the early days. Well, it's actually considered to be caused by herpes virus, human herpes virus 8. Mm-hmm. That was an aside. Going back to So HIV.
Was it something that would take advantage of another illness and appear with it, or?
It's unclear because Kaposi's sarcoma is rarely even to be seen in AIDS patients anymore, and I'm kind of getting off track here.
Okay, go ahead then. Sorry, go on your track.
We can circle back to that. Later. Anyway, so what they discovered, and by the way, the technology to count CD4 T cells, which is a subset of your white blood cells that help fight infections, they had quantified, they'd figured out how to quantify this. And when these people were coming in with opportunistic infections, they started counting their CD4 T cells and said, wow, these are really like very, very low in these patients, critically low. I think that a typical value would be 800 to 1200 copies or cells per milliliter of blood. And these people were coming in with under 500, under 200, sometimes in the single digits. And so the war on cancer had been happening in the 70s, and they'd been trying to find a retroviral cause for cancers, and that kind of didn't really go anywhere. Retrovirus research was very popular in the early 80s, and the people that were looking into this back at the time said, well, we need to find a virus that is tropic for these CD4 T cells. And that was how they settled on HIV, which was actually initially called HTLV-3 for human T lymphotropic virus 3. And they figured out, okay, this virus shows up in these T cells. Maybe it's what's causing the destruction. And then in a very unprecedented move, I'm not exactly sure, the politics behind this are still murky to me to this day. On March 23rd, 1984, Robert Gallo shows up on TV with the head of Health of Human Services, Margaret Heckler, whips off his sunglasses and said, ladies and gentlemen, we found the cause of AIDS. But there had been no papers in the medical literature published to that point that had established anything to do with HIV being the cause of AIDS. Those came a few months later. So
wow. Boy, that just
but
really
here's
makes
what gets
clear,
weird though.
It?
Here's what gets weird is that my contention, and I really believe that this is true, is that the research avenue became so narrowly focused and zoomed in so fast on CD4 T cells and anything that could cause them to be depleted, which, by the way, there's still no consensus understanding as to how HIV depletes CD4 T cells. And if you look in the medical literature, they're moving quietly away from a CD4 T cell depletion model of AIDS to a new theory that HIV is actually causing massive inflammation, which is fascinating because inflammation is not immune deficiency. It's actually hyperimmunity or autoimmunity.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I mean, so my question is, if in the early 80s we had been looking for something that was capable of causing massive inflammation and not just narrowly focusing on these T cells, which can be depleted in other disease states, then
all right,
things might be.
We're going to go to break now. That's not a bad place, and we'll be back very shortly. I hope folks are finding this interesting. You got to pay some good attention. Hi, folks. You're looking at Rebecca Smith. And
Kolchoff-Smith.
That's okay. Yes, I wasn't sure which to do. Her middle. That's your original name is Rebecca Kolchoff.
Rebecca Kolchoff. That's my maiden name. Kolchoff. That's the name my book's published under.
Oh, okay. Somehow Rebecca Smith got put up on the screen.
That's okay. I think that's because that's my email.
Oh, I got it.
But it's fine. Culshaw Smith, it's fine.
Well, if we could put up Culshaw, C-U-L-S-H-A-W, Rebecca, C-U-L-S-H-A-W. I'd love to have you, you know, just continue right where you were, finish your line of discussion about this whole issue of what is the cause of AIDS. And it sounds like it's a separate disorder. To the extent it's there, it's a separate disorder from HIV.
Well, here's something interesting, and I'm putting my math hat back on, is that HIV positivity, the prevalence of HIV positivity and the incidence of AIDS don't actually match. And this is fascinating. the viewers might not be aware that, first of all, AIDS was defined, I think, as only five diseases back in the early 80s. And it, you know, quickly exploded. It became a real problem. Then they put a bunch of people on AZT, which is a whole nother story.
Yeah.
I believe AIDS deaths peaked in 1993, and they started falling immediately after that, which is, by the way, a full 3 years before any of the triple drug combination therapies were rolled out. So there's that. But here's the interesting thing. HIV positivity has been the same prevalence since the mid-80s. It's been about 1 million Americans, barely changed. It's been basically constant. That is not how an infectious agent behaves. And I believe that whatever these tests are testing for is not an infectious agent. There's an amazing book from 2007 called The Origin, Persistence, and Failings of HIV/AIDS Theory by Henry Bauer, who is an emeritus dean of arts and sciences from Virginia Tech. And he did a deep, deep analysis into the prevalence of HIV positivity in every risk group, from people at low risk, like repeat blood donors, all the way to, you know, intravenous drug users who are considered to be at high risk. And what he discovered was that in every single risk group, HIV positivity was never zero. It was always there. And it was remarkably consistent in between ethnic groups. African Americans always test positive at a higher rate than Caucasians, and Caucasians test positive at a higher rate than Asians. That is not how an infectious agent behaves. That should have been the end of saying that HIV was an infectious agent. It baffles the mind to imagine that you have this brand new disease that shows up in 1980 and it's already everywhere. That the virus that supposedly causes it.
When it crops up, does it crop up at all in terms of households or communities or other things that we see with infectious agents?
Well, here's the thing. HIV is supposed to be transmitted sexually or through blood products. And mm-hmm. there's not a lot of medical literature to support it. When you actually look at the studies that look at sexual transmission, I think the risk is considered to be something like 1 in 1,000 for male to female transmission. And that came from a paper from the 1990s where they did this retrospective study, and they didn't even look at it in real time. They just did, they looked at, you know, who was positive and who was negative and figured, okay, it's a 1 in 1,000 chance. But the prospective study that they did, they followed, I can't remember how many, but it was quite a few serodiscordant couples. And a lot of them didn't use condoms consistently. They follow them for 10 years. Serodiscordant means one partner tests HIV positive and one tests negative. There were no seroconversions over 10 years, which kind of makes you wonder if you're measuring something that is sexually transmitted. If you really want to get into this, there's debate as to whether HIV is even an exogenous virus and what we're detecting when we detect HIV genetic material, it might be endogenous retroviral sequences. The human genome is something like 3%. I'm not sure about that number, but some non-trivial percentage of the human genome is composed of retroviral sequences, mm-hmm. some of which overlap with the retroviral sequences in HIV. And if you look, if your viewers are interested, the Perth group in Australia has done some outstanding research into what we're actually looking for when we look for HIV and whether it's even an exogenous from the outside virus or not. It could be.
Or just one that lives in human beings now.
It could be. Yeah, that's, it has not been proven that it isn't.
You know, there's an interesting somewhat comparison with lethargic encephalitis, which is a disease that sprung up toward the end of World War II, at about the time that the flu was raging and then cooling off. Mm-hmm. And the reason I got interested in it, wrote a paper about it, was that it mimicked all the symptoms of antipsychotic drug use.
Oh, fascinating.
It's a very, very similar. Lethargic encephalitis or lethargica encephalitis lethargica. It was sometimes called sleeping disease. And the people would develop Parkinsonism very often, just like the antipsychotic drugs. They develop all the abnormal movements that you see associated with tardive dyskinesia. They'd end up sometimes with psychosis, which you can see with these drugs, a tardive psychosis, although the doctors don't know about that or talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so I did an in-depth article on it, comparing the two, paralleling them. And the interesting thing for today that reminded me of is that the supposed agent has never been found. The disease has dwindled to rare or non-existent, depending on whether you admit that the same thing is caused by antipsychotic drugs, because the rare cases now have all had antipsychotic drugs, best as I could tell the last time I looked at it. And so it's close to non-existent. And there was never a finding of an infectious agent. They thought they found something and that they recreated monkeys, but that didn't pan out. But it also doesn't follow a particular pattern of where it'll show up in families or a community. Just showed up around the world. It was real. Mm-hmm. And it resulted in millions of very damaged human beings. And for many years, the most common Parkinsonism was a result of this. This is probably all new information for people.
Mm-hmm.
So there are very puzzling things out there in the world. And it sounds like the AIDS syndrome is the AIDS syndrome, I know you're not a medical doc, but is it a consistent syndrome from place to place and person to person? Can you say we're looking at something that looks alike, or is it
No, sir.
Okay.
Okay, so first of all, the definition of AIDS is circular. HIV has to be present for a diagnosis of AIDS. You could have all of the symptoms of AIDS, including the T-cell depletion, inflammation, all of that stuff. And if you test negative for HIV, you are not considered to be an AIDS patient, which to me, this is tragic because I will argue that there is a lot of HIV negative AIDS out there, probably more than we think. And we're doing a great disservice to those patients by focusing so much on just HIV. But let me just touch on this real quick. I believe that it's over 30 diseases in the presence of a positive HIV test result that will give you a diagnosis of AIDS, any one of those 30 diseases. At the beginning of the epidemic, people were getting Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis pneumonia, systemic candidiasis. Now, people who have AIDS-defining illnesses, I believe that it's more commonly cardiovascular events and lymphoma, which one could also argue have nothing to do with immunodeficiency. I believe the most common AIDS-defining illness at this point is tuberculosis. I could be wrong. Certainly in Africa, that's the case. But you can also be diagnosed with AIDS if you have invasive cervical cancer, which I believe was just put in there to inflate the number of women with AIDS. You can also be diagnosed with AIDS if you are not sick with any disease at all, but if you have a CD4 T cell count below 200 at any time. So it is not a consistent syndrome. I do believe that AIDS is real. I despise when people use the term denialist because I am not denying that AIDS is real. I believe that there is an epidemic of immune dysfunction, but I don't believe that it's caused by HIV.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. It's very consistent with what a lot of other intelligent people have concluded, and scientifically minded people like yourself. I never looked into it. I was so focused on psychiatric issues. You may not know, but I was proudly called the conscience of psychiatry, and that's
why. Oh no, I'm well aware of your
that's
history.
What I did.
Yes,
which meant, of course, I was probably the most disliked person in the field of psychiatry, because who likes their conscience? But I was really struck at the start of this epidemic how many people were saying, "Wow, this is." This is like a lot of the same stuff with AIDS. I mean, there's this huge push for a vaccine, mm-hmm. and they're going to have a vaccine, and they never got one.
No, a vaccine was promised, I believe, by 1986. To this point, I think there have been over 90 failed trials, including one that just failed last week. I can't remember the name of it.
The one they were advertising, probably.
You have to wonder if you cannot, like, whatever you want to say about the COVID vaccines, they managed to roll something out in about a year. The fact that you cannot even come up with any sort of a vaccine for HIV should maybe make people think that we might be barking up the wrong tree a little bit. But I'd like to go back a little bit to the concept of HIV negative AIDS, if you don't mind, because yeah. I think it's really important, and I think it's actually probably going to be the key to understanding the epidemic. As my late friend Liam Sheff once said, he said, AIDS is real, HIV is not. And we need a paradigm shift. And I believe that that's true. Mm-hmm. You're probably aware of chronic fatigue syndrome, for example.
Yes, I know there's been a lot of discussion about that and AIDS. Go ahead.
They used to call it AIDS light, right?
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about chronic fatigue syndrome and AIDS is that there's a lot of the same sorts of immune disruptions. It's just that they affect completely different risk groups. The diseases look awfully similar. I would argue that people who have chronic fatigue syndrome, and I think there's estimated to be something like 7 million in the United States. I would argue that they have immune deficiency. And believe, in fact, that chronic fatigue syndrome used to be called CFIDS, or chronic fatigue and immune dysfunction system. Is it syndrome? Sorry. So there's that. There's also something called idiopathic CD4 lymphocytopenia, which basically is a mouthful of a thing that says massive CD4 cell depletion in the absence of HIV. So literally HIV negative AIDS. And I think, we're not any closer to solving AIDS. We don't understand how HIV causes AIDS. There was some great quote from an AIDS researcher from early 2000s who said something like, well, we're still confused as to how HIV causes CD4 cell loss, but we're at least confused at a higher level of understanding. So, but it's been 40 years. It's been 40 years that we have been studying this microbe. We don't have a vaccine. We don't have a cure. We have some drugs that are possibly helping people in some ways. Here's something interesting. A lot of the anti-HIV drugs are strongly anti-inflammatory. So if what we're dealing with is an inflammatory syndrome, this might go a long way to explaining why in some cases they seem to work despite their horrible side effects. And you right. having been involved in psychiatry, I would draw the parallel perhaps with SSRIs and depression. Like, nobody knows how they work. They tend to harm some people. Some people, they make them a lot worse. But some people really do feel better when they take them. And
well, I think we do understand that. At least I've written that they're emotionally flattening. They just flatten people. And while the husband is sitting there and telling you he's feeling so much better since on the drug, the wife is likely to say, honey, you don't even love the dog anymore. Remember how you used to go to the front door? This is right out of my practice when we had front doors. They don't work. They poison the brain, and they are neurotoxins. And if there's something to be preferred about being toxic, then it works. So if you're somebody who's suffering a great deal and doesn't know that human suffering can be overcome through therapy, through God, through love, through life experiences. If you believe it's a biochemical imbalance, you know, you get hooked into taking the drug and thinking maybe it's helping, especially as you gradually lose your appreciation of life. And every single patient I've taken off of SSRIs has felt more alive. And then we've had to deal with feelings and emotions. And in many cases, it wasn't really difficult to get emotionally better once they got through their withdrawal. So, no, I would say maybe one difference is in psychiatry, the whole thing is fake. The whole thing is fake. And well, for the same purpose, though, power, money, control. Let me pick up on a couple of things that I think are critical to the comparison between AIDS and the AIDS situation. The first thing that's common is Anthony Fauci. And Fauci was the big manipulator of the entire, as far as I can tell, and certainly Bobby Kennedy seems to think in his book, is the big manipulator of the outcomes, working with the drug companies, getting tons of money spent on vaccines that don't work. Now we have also vaccines that don't work, but we're so immoral now, in fact, they kill people too, that and don't work well, that we've pushed them through now. I don't think they're any better probably than the ones that failed with AIDS. I think they're just being pushed through now. And another similarity with the poisonous drugs, remdesivir, is a drug known to be so bad that it had to be taken out of trials for Ebola because too many people were dying compared to the other drugs they were using. And then there's another similarity, which is Anthony Fauci's work. And that is that there's a pneumonia that would often accompany AIDS in the old days, at least. And Fauci, without any power to do so, convinced doctors, just like now, not to use an effective treatment for the pneumonia, which was a very cheap, inexpensive, well-tried, very overall safe drug. So we've got the Fauci pushing the vaccines, telling you there's no treatment when there was a treatment for the main killer at the time. You remember the name of the pneumonia?
Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. It's a fungal pneumonia.
Thank you. And so there's so many things that are familiar that I think we have to come away thinking, wow, I mean, it's always been like this. The people who run the world have always been corrupt, and the people who run big empires have always been corrupt. And we're looking at what Ginger and I think are the Eastern Empire of China and the Western Empire, Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab and the EU, and they all work through the World Health Organization. So we've got a formulation for the whole of what's going on now. But I think it's just been building and building, and people like Fauci are the henchmen. They're not really very high up. But they are there. Fauci was with Bill Gates for 10 years as his advisory committee for vaccines before the current pandemic.
I know we're running out of time, but I'd really there's one topic that I would absolutely
got 2.5 minutes, so run with it
really quickly. Okay, so one of the big changes that has happened in the world of HIV research since my first book came out is this concept of PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is basically, maybe you've seen these TV commercials. I'm sure some of your readers have seen these TV commercials. They're appallingly racist. And basically PrEP is this idea that to give people anti-HIV drugs who do not have HIV, people who are either at risk or are just concerned about getting HIV. And the idea is basically to use anti-HIV drugs as HIV vaccines. And the literature as to whether this works is all over the place in terms of its efficacy, and that's a topic for another day. But I just I want to sound the alarm about this because it's absolutely shocking to think that you would put completely healthy people with no sort of laboratory pathology, no symptoms whatsoever, on these toxic drugs that cause bone loss, kidney damage, liver damage, lipodystrophy, all sorts of side effects, and they want to give toxic chemotherapy to HIV negative people for life. And I think that people should be really concerned about the implications of this, not just for HIV. But I really wanted to mention
that. I am so glad you brought it up. Folks, I've come a long way. You know, I did not know all these things that I learned studying COVID-19 and with Ginger, you know, for 10, 12 hours a day, our ages no less, sometimes 15 hours a day. But it's all consistent with what I learned about psychiatry. And it's pretty much consistent with a lot of other things, agriculture, manufacturing. So much in the world today is controlled by global combines of one kind or another, and it's big money. One last thought I want to leave you with. People had enough chutzpah to rebel against Fauci. There were mass meetings, they weren't riots, they were just people coming to complain about Fauci filling up the grounds at NIH and making him feel humiliated. And we don't do any protesting anymore. And they were doing more back in the days of AIDS. Thank you so much, Rebecca Smith, Coleshaw for the book. Rebecca Coleshaw for the book.